This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
I documented dozens of cases of girls and women who were sexually abused and beaten as they foraged for wood, as they went back and forth to market, and as they fled their villages from fighting.
That was Corinne Dufka, the West Africa Director for Human Rights Watch, on the impact of unrest and worsening violence in Burkina Faso. Details coming up also. A Nigerian anti-corruption agency has arrested the country's top accountant. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Clashes erupted in Libya's capital yesterday as the parliament-appointed Prime Minister Fathi Bashagha tried to take control of the government from a rival unity government of Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dabiba that has refused to cede power. Bashagha entered Tripoli overnight after 2 months of stalemate between Libya's rival administrations, but withdrew hours later as fighting rocked the capital. Khalid al-Mashri, the head of the Libya's High Council of State, condemned the violence and called for an immediate cessation of hostilities. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University, analyzed these developments to VOA senior analyst Mohammed al-Shinawi.
First of all, this is not the Libyan parliament. It's a leftover portion of the parliament elected in 2014 that after those elections supported 6 years of warfare waged by the East against the West, just a portion of it. And now it's trying to impose a government from the East on the West, despite a UN-sponsored peace process and political process that it is undermining by this imposition. Eastern forces tried to take Tripoli by force in May 2014, April 2019, and twice now in 2022, which is not what parliaments do. Real parliaments, they win elections and then pick leaders. This one didn't do that. It was resuscitated only to support the UN political process. And these actions are undermining the very negotiations that the UN is sponsoring right now in Cairo. So no, it's not a parliament that has the legitimacy to appoint a prime minister, nor does it have the right under Libyan law or under the UN political process and the UN Security Council resolutions to impose a prime minister when there already is a prime minister. So saying that Dabiba is refusing to cede power, yes, it's a refusal, but it's a good refusal. You don't cede power to armed attackers. And that's what Bashagha is trying to do. There's an oil blockade orchestrated by the leading Eastern general, the warlord, General Haftar, but that's not a stalemate, that's a blockade. Now, there are UN-sponsored talks in Cairo. That's not a stalemate either. The talks are ongoing. As for the attempt to take the government by force, it was a colossal failure today, just like the previous attempt 2 months ago, because neither the majority of Libyans nor the majority of Libyan militias protecting the capital are in favor of the East taking power by force. Worse, the one militia that was siding with Bashagha today, because of his role in protecting the West against the East in 2019, before he changed sides and made an alliance with the East, they've been forced out of Tripoli permanently. So Bashagha is weakening his already weak position in the capital even further. He also weakened the UN political process negotiations in Cairo, which are there to agree on a constitutional basis for new elections to actually elect a prime minister. Elections that nearly all Libyans want to bring about a new legitimate government rather than the vestiges of an eight-year-old parliament that waged 6 years of war trying to impose its will by force of arms.
Does this crisis risk plunging Libya back into prolonged fighting after 2 years of comparative peace, or returning it to partition between the Eastern-backed government of Bashagha and a Tripoli administration under Abdulhamid Dabiba?
So yes on the first question and no on the second question, because that's already the state we're in. So on the first question, it does risk prolonged fighting, But this is still relatively unlikely because nobody really wants it. So unless Haftar imposes prolonged fighting by choice, there won't be prolonged fighting because the West isn't trying to conquer the East in a prolonged way. It's just trying to hold elections. As for the ceasefire, it's now held for nearly 2 years. And the foreign backers have been pressured not to prolong the war. Also, that was their calculation because the East started to lose the war. So to prevent the West from pushing all the way up to the Egyptian border, it made more sense to hold a ceasefire and then bargain for a political outcome. So Egypt, UAE have made the calculation that losing further is not the right way to go. Russia is distracted by Ukraine, and Turkey is just fine with staying away from the Egyptian border, but making sure the East doesn't conquer the West again. As for partition, we won't be returning to it because that's what we've had since February. Again, a partition imposed by the East, which first stopped the December elections and then tried to force its preferred outcome in the elections that didn't happen on the West. So the only question now is how to come up with a deal that gets us to elections so that both administration of the West, which came out of the UN process, and administration of the East, which is imposing itself, get replaced by legitimate leaders. Libyans don't want a partition of the country permanently, and the best evidence of that is both prime ministers are from Misrata, which is a central city, and therefore both sides are saying we'd like to control all of Libya, not a partitioned Libya.
That's William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. A report by Human Rights Watch finds civilians in Burkina Faso are suffering from an increase in attacks by armed Islamist groups and government security forces. The conflict has displaced millions and increased recruitment into armed groups, as Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
A report by Human Rights Watch finds civilians in Burkina Faso are suffering from an increase in attacks by armed Islamist groups and government security forces. The conflict has displaced millions and increased recruitment into armed groups, as Annika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal. The escalating attacks include widespread killings, rapes, and the pillaging of goods, according to the report. The conflict began in 2016 and has since destabilized nearly the entire Sahel region. But Burkina Faso has seen the worst of the violence, and conditions are deteriorating. Nearly 600 people were killed between January and April of this year, triple the number in the same period in 2021, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. The number of people displaced has also risen, reaching more than 1.8 million by the end of February of this year, a more than 4% increase since the end of January. In addition to terrorist groups, government security forces have become increasingly abusive and subjected civilians to unlawful killings and abductions, the report said. Corinne Defka is the West Africa director for Human Rights Watch. She says she's covered Burkina Faso for years and is particularly concerned by new atrocities being committed that she hadn't seen before.
Notably, the rape of girls and women. I documented dozens of cases of girls and women who were sexually abused and beaten as they foraged for wood, as they went back and forth to market, and as they fled their villages from fighting.
Other new abuses include the recruitment of child soldiers, the use of mortars to target villages, and the placement of IEDs along main roads. The explosive devices have killed dozens of civilians and impeded the delivery of humanitarian aid. Burkina Faso's elected government was overthrown in January by military forces that blamed then-President Roch-Marc Christian Kabore for the rise in jihadist-linked violence. But in the more than 3 months since the coup, the junta itself has failed to reverse the trend and restore peace and stability. In early April, transitional president Lieutenant Colonel Ponori Sandaogo Damiba said he was implementing a new strategy that would show results within 5 months. The changes include replacing heads of command, improving equipment, and calling in retired military personnel. Fahiraman Rodrigone is a senior Sahel researcher with the Institute for Security Studies in Bamako. He said counterterrorism operations have been undermined by corruption and a lack of coordination.
We all know that this fighting against jihadist militant group won't be achieved by military way. So if there is serious dialogue, community-based dialogue, this will be a good option.
Kone said he expects some improvement in the security situation as the government now appears to be considering peace talks. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
In Nigeria's anti-corruption agency has arrested the country's top accountant over the alleged theft of millions of dollars. To learn more about the scandal, I talked to Medina Dauda, VOA's Abuja Bureau coordinator. She starts out by explaining briefly the responsibilities of Nigeria's Accountant General's office and proceeds to tell us who the accused office holder is and who appointed him to the prestigious post.
The Accountant General of the Federation is the administrative head of the Treasury of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. And the office holder is often appointed by the President of Nigeria to serve a four-year term in accordance with the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. Alhaji Ahmed Idris was appointed by President Muhammadu Buhari in 2015 when he assumed office.
Medina, how did this high-ranking official finally get arrested?
The Accountant General, Alhaji Ahmed Idris, was arrested on Monday by the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission over alleged 80 billion naira fraud, which is an equivalent of 190 million US dollars. The EFCC spokesman, Wilson Uwujaren, said Idris was arrested after failing to honor the commission's invitations. The comments of the spokesperson showed that the Accountant General raked off the funds through bogus consultancies and other illegal activities using proxies like his family members and close associates. According to Uwujaren, the funds were laundered through real estate investments in Kano and Abuja.
Now that he is arrested, what will be his fate moving forward?
So if they are able to establish these offenses against Alhaji Ahmed Idris, who is the Accountant General of the Federation since 2015, then he could be prosecuted and jailed. But first, they have to take him to court and give him the opportunity to defend himself.
That was Medina Dauda, VOA's Abuja Bureau Coordinator. She was speaking to me from Abuja, Nigeria. Former Somali leader Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, who won the presidency again on Sunday in a vote by parliamentarians, faces a number of challenges, including trying to foster unity in the divided country. He spoke in an exclusive interview with Abdulaziz H. Osman from VOA Somali Service about his victory and goals.
This is a history in the making. I'm the first president since the independence that has been elected twice in the office, according or in line with our constitution. So that's a history, and it's a good history. Then the second, my vision is Somalia in peace with itself and in peace with the rest of the world. That was the motto and the slogan that we had. Other than that, we have certain priorities to make sure that we achieve. The top priority, the top number one, number two, number three priority is the security. We need to see a secure Somalia, Somali state or government that can take the full responsibility of the security of its people. We believe that we have a big agenda of transformation in Somalia, but we cannot implement that agenda unless we make sure that the Somalia is safe and secure. That's number one. Number two, next to that is the political stability of the country. We don't want the political infighting within the government, the center and the periphery fighting or institutions fighting each other. So political stability and security of the people, particularly the movement of the goods and the people throughout Somalia, is a top priority for us. Safe Somalia, secure Somalia is a safe region in the Horn of Africa, so that we, by eliminating the menace of Al-Shabaab, does not mean only securing Somalia or eliminating one problem of Somalia. It's a regional problem, international problem that's being solved. So we are very much grateful for the international communities in support of Somalia, particularly.
President Biden got us to send Somalia American troops. How was your take on that?
And that was a very good step taken towards the right direction by the President of the United States, President Biden. The United States is the biggest supporter and the biggest donor in Somalia in terms of humanitarian everything. And on top of it, the United States is the biggest donor as well in the security and the defense. So that by taking that, by reversing the past decision of former President Donald Trump, it was absolutely timely and a very good decision. The Somali people receives that decision very well, and we're looking forward to receive that support. The United States not only give us money and material, but they give us their own blood and their own lives to liberate Somalia.
There's a drug in the country. So close to the farm. Did you get any update on it?
Yes, the roads are very difficult. I'm going to appoint a special envoy for the drought in the country, and it's also a very difficult time at this time. People lost their livestock. People has not the old types of farming and production. So Somalia is not in a security risk of Al-Shabaab and physical security only, but also food security. There is a serious matter of food security, and that's going to be part of the overall security of Somalia. So the United States in that regard is also the biggest donor in supporting humanitarian aid for Somalia.
That was Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, who was elected as Somalia's president again on Sunday, speaking with Abdulaziz H. Osman from VOA Somali Service. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. The government of Mozambique says its troops, bolstered by foreign forces, have brought greater stability to its northern Cabo Delgado province. Since October 2017, 3,500 people have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced in what Maputo has called an Islamic terrorist insurgency. President Filipe Nyusi's office recently released its reconstruction plan for Cabo Delgado, sparking immediate criticism from local and international civil society organizations who say it will perpetuate the inequalities and injustices fueling the conflict. Darren Taylor reports.
Troops from Rwanda and several southern African countries are battling extremists who claim affiliation to the Islamic State or ISIS International Terror Network. The insurgents say they're fighting to improve the lives of local residents. Cabo Delgado has immense wealth, including oil, natural gas, and gemstones. Yet its people remain poor. Professor Armindo Ngunga is chairman of the government's Integrated Development Agency for the North.
This is not a conventional war which ends by signing an agreement anyway, because in this particular case, the terrorists are faceless in terms of leadership. We don't know who is behind them, who we could negotiate with them. We as government are the ones who are the victims.
But one of the world's foremost experts on Mozambique, American social scientist Dr. Joseph Hanlon, argues that external Islamic aggression is not central to the conflict, that it just suits Maputo to present it that way and cast itself as the primary victim.
Are these really faceless people? Or are there grievances about lack of jobs, marginalization, and the failure of the majority to benefit from resources? And this is clearly split for Limo. The official line is there are no grievances. But even Grasse Michel and Radio Mozambique are now raising the issue of grievances.
Ngunga insists his agency's priority is to make better lives. He says when terrorist attacks waned a few months ago, it opened a window for rebuilding in Cabo Delgado.
That's when the plea was made to invite donors and all supporters for the reconstruction of Cabo Delgado. The government set up a plan of the reconstruction of Cabo Delgado, which is worth $300 million.
The World Bank, which is footing the bill, says the targets are health and education infrastructure and economic opportunities. But Hanlon says Maputo's reconstruction plan is instead aimed at facilitating government access to Cabo Delgado's natural resources by constructing state buildings, roads, and communications infrastructure. He says the plan doesn't mention anything about job creation or how residents could benefit from the vast wealth under their feet and in their seas.
In other words, returning to the antebellum past, treating the war just like a cyclone, an act of God. It was not our fault. Nothing needs to change. We just repair the damage. With one exception, the government is not encouraging the 800,000 displaced people to return home. Instead, it wants the aid industry to take care of them where they are now, indefinitely.
Ngunga responds that it's still too dangerous for most people to return home because the terrorists remain a threat. But Hanlon's convinced that safety and development of Cabo Delgado's people is a side issue. The main issue, he maintains, is access to the province's riches, a dogfight that's happening within Frelimo itself and between foreign powers, including South Africa and France.
There's another brawl between all the people from the aid agencies who want to help, or at least say they want to help. There are currently four different aid agency groupings trying to coordinate foreign aid in Cabo Delgado, while the government is trying to force the aid through the Council of Ministers and President Nussi. And there's yet another punch-up going on inside the government. One aspect is who takes decisions and sets aid policy. Another is who gets contracts and commissions.
Civil society groups say one solution is an independent organization administering funds and coordinating development in Cabo Delgado. But, says Hanlon, that would still leave all the natural resource wealth in the hands of the government, and the discontent that's driving the conflict will continue. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A Nigerian court today denied a bail request for separatist leader Nnamdi Kanu, who is standing trial on terrorism charges and for broadcasting falsehoods. A judge said Kanu has to account for his whereabouts following previous bail and refusal to attend court hearing, his lawyer told Reuters. Kanu, a British citizen who leads the band Indigenous People of Biafra, IPOB, disappeared from Nigeria after skipping bail in 2017. He was arrested after years on the run. IPOB, which Kanu founded in 2014, is pressing for the secession of parts of southeast Nigeria where the majority of the population belongs to the Igbo ethnic group. IPOB says it wants to achieve independence through non-violent means. However, Nigerian authorities view IPOB as a terrorist group. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.